In the desert, light reclaims itself as noun, a presence, not for the serving the illumination of other things, but for being itself, a sovereign character in the greater story.
Into the fullness of this season of lights, of Hanukkah, solstice, Christmas, and Kwanzaa, we bring poems and music that we hope give you peace, wonder, and rest, a quiet joy in these shortest days and longest nights of the year. Our featured guest, New Hampshire poet L.R. Berger, draws us through her beautiful images into noticing the sacred in the ordinary, everyday moments that, seen through the lens of her care and close attentions, return us to a sense of wonder. When I was a little girl, I would curl up at night in the cushioned recess of an old bay window and watch the snow pour out of the darkness. This was enough happiness for me. But I also knew that if I kept my eyes peeled to the myriad crystals rivering out of the blackness, I'd begin to feel myself rocketing through not snow, but stars. A trick of the eye, sure, but the feeling of ascending through a universe of streaming stars was real enough. I had the uncanny sense my small body was in two places at once, and was not at all surprised many years later to learn that in the quantum world, this doubleness is business as usual. My experience back then has never left me. It connected me to winter and to the night in a way that feels in some sense holy to me still. I'm Kimberly Green, and you're listening to the 9th episode of Rice Pudding Poetry. We're grateful you're here with us. Along with L.R., I'm pleased to welcome our friend and neighbor John Pritchard, who's composed original Native American flute music for this show. His pieces are by turns soothing, haunting, spacious, and somehow animate, a breathing presence that evokes both the incorporeal and the material. And of course, rice pudding wouldn't be rice pudding without our community readers. We're grateful to welcome David Frainer, Elizabeth Ontalik, Kathy Wolf, and Mimi White, each of whom will read a published poem on the theme of everyday wonders. We'll begin now with the first of John's flute meditations, untitled, and offering here an entrance into the early winter atmosphere of this show.
Thank you.
Our featured poet, L.R. Berger, is the recipient of fellowships and awards from the National Endowment for the Arts, the Penn New England Discovery Award, the New Hampshire State Council on the Arts, McDowell, Hedgebrook, the Blue Mountain Center, and Wellspring, and a visiting artist at the American Academy in Rome. Her book, The Unexpected Aviary, received the Jane Kenyon Award for Outstanding Book of Poetry, and her newest collection of poems, called Indebted to Wind, was published in August by Deerbrook Editions in Cumberland, Maine. We're so grateful to have you with us, L.R.
A warm thank you and welcome to everyone listening. I'm L.R. Berger, and I'm so thankful to be here for this Rice Pudding Poetry Series. The actual embodied experience of moments I might call sacred are usually unanticipated and always located in the geography of relationship. The relationship might be with a night sky, a stray cat, a fallen tree, a long-lost friend. All these moments involved a shift in my quality of consciousness and a subtle change in the frequency in my body. It's not so much like a spell being cast, but like the spell of the familiar being broken. Poems aren't sacred so much as they are sometimes the medium for transmitting the felt experience of a sacred moment, given by the world to the poet, through the poet to the poem, and with hope from the poem to the reader and listener. These first two poems I'm going to read appeared in my earlier collection of poems, The Unexpected Aviary. The first pays tribute to how the body recognizes awe, reflexively bringing a hand to the mouth. Hand to mouth. Like the hand of Job cupped to his mouth, our irrepressible gesture in the face of dark news, improbable beauty, anything larger than we might have imagined one moment earlier. Mate to gasping. During Bach's Toccata and Fugue, birds swoop as shadows behind the stained glass window, sifting down through Mary's crown, nestling into her lap. The apostles' eyes fixed Godward for all these years, satisfied, my hand rising as if called to my mouth. Like drawing a conch to an ear, some message concerning awe transmitted between them, involuntary as breath or tears, speaking for the unspeakable. The act of sweeping. A woman is sweeping her porch as if all life depended on it, dowsing for counsel through the press of an old broom, through some small, sure act she can be certain does no harm. Wind rouses, loosening leaves from even the stiffest branches, and sets the tiny green boat on the bay, rocking like our wavering scales of justice. She could be paddling herself across. Wind sweeps the porch. A crow who walked the plank bobs on one quivering wrist of pine, springs off as if to dive, but rises. These next poems are all from my new book, Indebted to Wind. Wind is an important character in my story, and threads its way through many of the poems in this collection, appearing, you might say, as an agent for disrupting the familiar. Indebted to Wind. Not what it had to say, but what it carried to you. Dandelion silk, dispatching seed, the neighbor's trash can lid, waking you from that nightmare hurled in a tempest against the bedroom window. Howling, love cry, lamentation. Wind carries out the past and in the future, tutors your own breath to extinguish the flame. When love unbuttoned your blouse, wind did the rest, fumbling through the aspens. You could have believed air was empty space to be lost in, except for wind stinging your face at the height of January, whipping the flag, lifting the sparrow. The next poem is dedicated to the beloved Wendell Berry and begins with an epigraph from his early Sabbath poems collection. A long and overdue letter to Wendell Berry. And the epigraph is, I needed what was lost, although I love as well the flow that took it. This morning in a late Adirondack September, I walked the mile path to the lake through the woods, your Sabbath poems in the pocket of my old denim jacket. When I say old, you can rest assured, I'm pledged to words keeping faith with their actual meanings. I know it by heart, the trails rises and bends, a rutted, stone-studded passage of filtered light and layers of shadow. And I know how it ends, spilling you suddenly out, the wide eye of the lake startling, no matter you knew what was coming. When I get there, I usually sit cross-legged on the bank until my rear can't take being any sorer. I read to the lake whatever mood it's in, windrift, rain-pocked, tranquil, glassy, sky mirror. But this morning, a motorboat was tied in the nearby boathouse slip. It had been sitting unridden long enough for the spiders to have accomplished weaving their embodied sermons on interconnection, pail to wheel, wheel to bow, bow to port, port to pail, their daily work refuting the gospel of private and property. So I pulled the boat and its vinyl stuffed seat toward me, climbed in and floated guiltless in its welcoming hull. I read your poems to the then silent loons, the teeming lake and the crows' unfettered accompaniment. I read to the crowns of just turning trees, to the evergreens and all the lives they go on sheltering here. Meanwhile, the winds had whipped up as I was reading about the futility of building a better world, because how could the world be any better? The boat knocking harder when I decided I'd better climb out. I was lower than the slip the boat was tied to, so had to grip and pull, maneuvering one leg up and across. That's when your book fell between the boat and the slip, into the crack always open between one world and every other. Except for my moan, there was only the sound of weight hitting weightlessness, your pages soaked and swallowed, sinking utterly out of reach. Probably it won't surprise you, but I wanted you to know. Your poems gave themselves up easily, less a drowning than a homecoming, less an accident than the shared desire of lake and language for each other. It was a perfect ceremony of surrender. Even our own words never belonged to us. This next poem's title is "And Still Dawn." The full moon lingers over my right shoulder while winter's sun rises. Pastel horizon under a procession of sheer lingerie, frayed wisps sailing ever so slowly by. Nothing rushed, a tutorial in the art of gradually. Thanks to the perch of this hill, I'm parallel with the airborne, geese, blue heron, crows. Without spectacles, all the things of this world are soft as milk glass and further out of reach. Barer trees, fewer places to hide, provocation for tenderness, waves of it. My aging body, the welcoming shore. The last poem I'm going to share is written in four parts and takes place in Abiquiu, New Mexico. Carlotta at Home. 1. With only instinct for compass and wounds demanding a vast horizon, she sought out this mesa encircled by mountains like any woman overtaken by a call from midlife to start over. She didn't build so much as raise this house up from sand into air, doused ledge for water, and then, defying whatever odds were left to defy, planted 7 plum trees for 7 friends death came too early for. 2. In the desert, light reclaims itself as noun, a presence, not for the serving the illumination of other things, but for being itself, a sovereign character in the greater story. The plum tree saplings are young, still sure light exists only for their ripening. And who'd argue with the bravado of spindly branches in the desert bearing the preposterous weight of all their plums? 3. When Carlotta holds out a basket pretending to wonder if I'd care to harvest the plums, we both know the real question. Can I bear the weight of such happiness in a chore? First plum in the basket, next plucked for my mouth, tithing warm juice and flesh, a few dropped for birds. Quicksilver sky, hardy pit at the heart, the fruits of a woundedness transfigured, Carlotta humming behind me. 4. Everything in the desert testifies to the improbable. Late afternoon winds fly in, carrying the blackbirds Carlotta says roost every night in the crowns of the 7 plum trees. Behind the wind, a dark bank in the distance is driving rain across the desert toward us. The plum leaves quiver, offering up their earthly applause. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, LR, for your lovely reading. Poems of presence and close attention. Your quiet and wonder, a pathway to deeper appreciation and connection. You can buy LR's newest book, Indebted to Wind, at your local bookstore, or you can buy it directly through her publisher, Deerbrook Editions, at www.deerbrookeditions.com. Poems are, at least partly, our records of having stopped to notice something, to see more deeply, and in so doing, to understand the self and the other in a new light, perhaps, to find relationship, as LR says, with what we might have passed by. The poems our community readers have brought to us find wonder in salt, the process of rot and decomposition, coffee, and ribbons. And if you listen closely, you'll hear what awe comes of stopping for these everyday things.
This is David Frainer from Greenland, New Hampshire. Tonight's poet, L.R. Berger, offers as our theme, The Sacred in the Ordinary. The poem I'll be sharing is Ode to Salt by Pablo Neruda. Salt certainly is ordinary. Theologian Sam Keen suggests, the sacred is discovered in what moves and touches us, in what makes us tremble. And Abraham Maslow adds, the sacred is in the ordinary. It is to be found in one's daily life, in one's neighbors, friends, and family, in one's own backyard. To be looking elsewhere for miracles is to me a sure sign of ignorance that everything is miraculous. In the poem, the word pampa refers to Chilean lowlands where salt mines lie. Ode to Salt by Pablo Neruda. This salt in the salt cellar I once saw in the salt mines. I know you won't believe me, but it sings. Salt sings. The skin of the salt mine sings with a mouth smothered by the earth. I shivered in those solitudes when I heard the voice of the salt in the desert. Near Antofagasta, the nitrous pampas resounds, a broken voice, a mournful song. In its caves, the salt moans, mountains of buried light, translucent cathedral crystal of the sea, oblivion of the waves. And then, on every table in the world, salt. We see your piquant powder sprinkling vital light upon our foods. Preserver of the ancient holds of ships, discoverer on the high seas, earliest sailor of the unknown, shifting byways of the foam. Dust of the sea, in you the tongue receives a kiss from ocean night. Taste imparts to every seasoned dish your ocean essence, the smallest miniature wave from the salt cellar, reveals to us more than domestic whiteness. In it we taste infinitude.
My name is Elizabeth Antalik. I live in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and I've chosen a poem by Patty Ann Rogers, an award-winning writer born in Joplin, Missouri, whose work lavishes fetal bats, horned lizards, and other ostensibly homely subjects with close, tender, and transcendent consideration. geocentric. Indecent, self-soiled, bilious reek of turnip and toadstool decay, dribbling the black oil of wilted succulents, the brown fester of rotting orchids, in plain view, that stain of stinkhorn down your front, that leaking roil of bracket fungi down your back, you purple-haired, grainy-fuzzed smolder of refuse, fathering fumes and boils and powdery mildews, enduring the constant interruption of sink-mire flatulence, contagious with earwax, corn smut, blister rust, backwash, and graveyard debris, rich with manure bog and dry rot, harboring not only egg-addled garbage and wrinkled lip of orange peel mold, but also the clotted breath of overripe radish and burnt leek, bearing every dank, malodorous rut and scarp, all sulfur fissures and fetid hillside seepages, old, old, dependable, engendering forever the stench and stretch and warm seeth of inevitable putrefaction. Nobody loves you as I do.
Hello, I'm Kathy Wolfe, and I live in Kittery, Maine. I met New Hampshire poet Bill Burtis more than 40 years ago when we both worked at UNH. Before New Hampshire, Bill lived in Iowa, where he had an early morning shift in a motel cafe. When he heard many years later that poet Stephen Cusisto complained there were no good poems about coffee, he remembered that job, and he wrote Coralville. It's in his recent book, Liminal. I think Coralville presents coffee as the quiet daily sacrament it deserves to be. Along the straight highway, through the stubbled fields, the Rock Island freight crew climbs the snowy hill to the motel coffee shop, where they will order jelly omelets, toast white, coffee black. The waitress ignores the faint aroma of metal and sweat, a mist rising in the heat off their dickies as she pours the coffee, swirling steam into mugs the men grip with two hands, warming fingers burning with cold. Behind them, down the slope, their diesels thrum on the siding, waiting for the Southwest chief to thunder past, headed for Kansas City, her passengers sipping coffee, contemplating the horizon, the flatness of the empty prairie, the long freight blurring by. Then the crew stands from their stools with the slow stiffness of working men. Cash on the counter, plenty of tip, cups drained of coffee, they zip bulky parkas and head out the door. The waitress clears the counter, scooping bills and coin into the bib around her waist, clutches the coffee pot, and moves down the line, waving the steaming vessel like a semaphore, filling cups and clearing empty plates. Later, she'll pour coffee for truckers, construction workers, linemen, some who know her name and some who only tip their caps. 3:30, the long sun slanting in the back windows. She empties the last pots, takes her tips, says good night to the cook. Outside, a slight snow wavers in a west wind. Pulling her coat closed, she fishes for her keys as she crunches across the parking lot. A mile down the road, she parks at a small cape. In the kitchen, a man stands at the table, raises his coffee cup for a last drink just before she hugs him, reaching up to kiss him on the cheek, catching his smile in the darkened window above the sink. He's leaving for second shift, heading out to the pickup with his lunch pail and thermos of coffee.
Hi, I'm Mimi White from Rye, New Hampshire, and I'm going to read a poem from L.R. Berger's first collection, The Unexpected Aviary. It's not so much what the carpenter's son finds, but where he finds it. This poem makes me think about what's right under my nose that I keep missing. This boy teaches me to believe, then to see. The Carpenter's Son. When the carpenter's son's six-year-old Uriah picks out a music box from a carton in my attic, I tell him it's broken. He opens the lid, winding the already overworked key, and the minuet I haven't heard for 20 years plucks its tin pan song. I'm a Christian, he says, as if by way of explanation. The word broken means nothing to him. God's in your music box, he announces, as we climb down complaining stairs, and he trails me out, cupping it like a nestling. He sets it down inside the garden. He watches me untangle, then carefully stake each heavy, pungent vine. God's in your tomato plants, he says. Still, I break some. Then he draws through his believing fingers the tail of every blue-grained ribbon I spliced and knotted around the fence for discouraging birds. The word discourage means nothing to birds. You know, he says, God's in your ribbons.
Thank you, David, Elizabeth, Kathy, and Mimi, for your poems and your voices. And thank you, John, for giving us your beautiful flute music to weave into this part of our show, like braiding with wind. Please join us next time, February 17th, for our 10th episode. Rice Pudding Poetry is a project of Rice Public Library in Kittery, Maine, and we thank all the good people there who are busy planning for the reopening of the enlarged and redesigned building this spring. Thank you, too, to sound engineer Douglas Green and to graphic designer Sophie Green. Our theme music is Pussyhat, composed by Kent Allen and Joyce Anderson. I'm Kimberly Green, and I'm most thankful for you, dear listeners, near and far. Take good care, everyone. We hope this helping of rice pudding has been nourishing for all the good work you do in the world. Bye for now.